Well, good evening, everybody. My name is David Goldblatt. Thank you very much for coming. Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here, great pleasure to see you. And this evening's subject is Hillsborough, 20 years on. 20 years isn't actually a very long time, it strikes me, to try and heal the wounds and deal with the aftermath of such an extraordinary trauma and such an extraordinary set of losses for the people involved. And one of the most important things that strikes me about an evening like this is simply the act of remembering. I suspect that there will never be a complete truth, and I suspect there will never be complete justice for the victims and their families. And the very least that we can do in the face of that is to bear testament to the event and to continue to remember and to argue the story as we understand it. It also strikes me that the lessons and the memory of Hillsborough retain direct relevance in all sorts of ways to the world of football and beyond. Only 3 weeks ago in Côte d'Ivoire, during a World Cup qualifying game, another 19 football fans perished in a suffocating crush in a football stadium. And although nothing on the scale of Hillsborough has reoccurred in Britain since 1989, in a rough calculation that I did from my own knowledge, I would say at least 1,000 football fans have died in the last 20 years in crushes, fires in football stadiums across the world. It also struck me, reading the reports of the G20 demonstration and the behaviour of the police force to those demonstrators, that the issue of how our police force treats its citizens remains a very live issue. I've been asked just to begin this evening by giving a little bit of context. Looking round the room, some of you will certainly be old enough to have been present or to have seen Hillsborough on the television. Some of you may not. Clearly, there were all sorts of individuals who were deeply culpable on the day. My intention is not so much to go over the ground of individual culpability, but just to sketch a bit of the context in which a series of disastrous and in the end fatal decisions were made by those in power. The context of the 1980s and football is above all the era of Thatcherism, in which football fans became bundled up with the other enemies of the state, the enemy within, as they were known, from the miners to other trade unionists, to all forms of working class and radical opposition in the 1980s. And this is an era, you may recall, in which the government was on the verge of introducing an ID card scheme in an attempt to take control of football stadiums. But more telling, I think, than the machinations of the Thatcher government was the state of the football infrastructure and the perspective within which football was viewed by the police and indeed by the football authorities itself. It's worth remembering, I think, that on the day of the Hillsborough disaster, the trouble really began in a courtyard outside of the stadium. Around 10,000 to 15,000 Liverpool fans, many arriving late because of traffic problems, not budgeted for, I should say, by the police on the day, were attempting to enter a stadium through a set of turnstiles that had been installed in 1927. And there were seven turnstiles to handle something in the region of 6,000 to 10,000 football fans in the space of perhaps 20 minutes. That in itself is emblematic of the derelict and disgraceful state into which British football stadiums had descended by 1989, along with much of the rest of the country's infrastructure. In that courtyard, prior to the crush, there was enormous pressure of fans arriving late, desperate to get in to see the semi-final. And once again, it's an indicator to me of how football fans were perceived by the authorities, that the crush that was already building up in front of these turnstiles, in which men, women and children were in a state of visible discomfort, was handled by the police by sending in mounted police officers on horseback. And I just want you to think for a moment what an extraordinary situation it is when a desperate crush that is emerging is handled by sending police officers on horses, big horses, into the midst of it. As you might imagine, that simply made matters worse. And finally, the order was given to open a gate to the side of those turnstiles, through which the now desperate crowd poured. And they poured into the stand at Hillsborough, and there were three pens into which they could have gone. And that in itself is an extraordinary thing, that not merely was there fencing at the front of the stand, separating fans from the pitch, but the stand itself was divided into three pens with wire on either side. It is hard not to think that the way in which football fans, paying customers, citizens of this country were treated was at best as cattle and at worst as wild beasts. More extraordinary, perhaps, even than that, is that from today's perspective, where every football ground is absolutely full to the gills with yellow-coated stewards asking us to sit down and stop swearing, that no one was standing in front of those, in front of that tunnel, and could have indicated to the crowd that was about to pour through that they could have gone to either side of the central pen where the main crush happened. The police officer in charge on the day, as you may know, had never taken control of a major football game in his life. And that, again, is an indicator of the disregard and, I would say, almost the contempt with which football fans had been held. And when one recognises the depth and the scale of that contempt amongst the authorities responsible for citizen safety, it is hardly surprising, though no less shocking to think that the events that then transpired, the failure to unlock the gates, the failure to perceive the crush as a crush rather than, as it was by many police officers at the time, as a incident once again of trouble at a football ground, the failure to allow ambulances into the stadium, the failure to stop the game early, and most shockingly of all, I think, for me, recalling the day on the television, was the sight of police officers forming up in a defensive cordon across the halfway line before even the gates in the fences had been opened, as if they were awaiting some attack or storming of the pitch by a group of people who were slowly dying in those pens. So, although many individuals and many decisions taken on the day were deeply culpable and deeply wrong, it remains the case that they were taken in the context of a contempt and a disregard for citizen safety. That is alarming, and it strikes me as not entirely past. To discuss it in more detail and to bear witness and testament to the events of 1989, we have two speakers this evening. Daniel Bennett from Bristol Radical History Group, who was present at Hillsborough on the day in one of the stands along the side of the pitch, and Sheila Coleman, who has been working for the last 20 years for the Hillsborough Justice Campaign. We're going to take a short talk from each of them, and then I very much hope that all of you will feel able to contribute your own recollections and your own opinions of the day. As I said, I don't expect there is going to be very much justice in the end for the victims of Hillsborough and their family, but there is a responsibility on all of us on a day like today to do the best we can to bear testament and to bear witness to that day and to their memories. Daniel.
I am a lawyer by trade, but that's I'm not here this evening to talk about the law and the legal struggles involved. I've had some sporadic involvement over the last 20 years in little bits of the campaign, but nothing compared to that which Sheila's been involved in, so I'm going to leave all those issues to her. What I'm going to do tonight is firstly give my witness evidence as to what happened, what I saw, which principally concerns what happens after 3:15, the cut-off point. And then I'm going to read a statement from the ambulance man, Tony Edwards, the one who went to the ground, which again involves events after 3:15. 3:15 is significant because that's the date the coroner decided that everyone was dead, and therefore there was no point after 3:15 investigating what happened. On 15th April 1989, I attended the Liverpool-Notts Forest game at Hillsborough with my brother and his friend Peter. We arrived in Sheffield at around 1:30 and got into the ground relatively early, I think about 2:20. We had seats in the main stand to the left of the Leppings Lane end. Our seats were about halfway up the stand and about halfway between the Leppings Lane end and the halfway line. Accordingly, we had a very clear view of events. By 3:15, I could clearly see that the middle section of the Leppings Lane ends was overfull with people and that the two side sections were empty. It was clear at this stage that action was needed to move people to the side sections. I discussed this at the time with my brother and with his friend Pete, and it was also a general topic of conversation all around us. It was clear to everyone. I've been attending football matches regularly since I was 6, and I was well aware of how a full standing section looked. It was clear that the middle two sections, the Leppings Lane end, was overfull. Sat around us were many people who we recognised from regular attendance at Anfield's main stand. They had also been aware of how full the ends should have looked and how full it did look. By 3:00, it was already clear that people were injured. A boy aged about 15 years old was wandering alongside the touchline before the game started. His arm was broken at right angles, both below and above his elbow, forming a Z shape. He reached the halfway line before stewards led him away. Fans were trying to climb out of the middle section of the end over the front railings before the game started and over the sides. Fans from the stand above were pulling people up from the back. This was occurring in large numbers, not just the occasional person. Policemen were standing by the railings trying to prevent people from climbing over. I could clearly see that policemen were pushing people back into the stand. Even from where I was sitting, you could see that many people were in a lot of difficulty. At 3:04, the game was stopped by the referee. The police had by then realised that many people were injured and stopped trying to push people back into the stands. However, they did not appear to be doing anything to help. Their main actions were aimed at pushing people off the pitch and preventing anyone from progressing down the pitch. As time passed, the number of fans on the pitch increased and the numbers of injured and dead people increased. Before I left the ground, I witnessed the following actions by the police. First, they attempted to prevent fans from removing the goal structure. This was necessary because injured fans were falling on top of other injured fans as they escaped the Leppings Lane end. I could see that it was impossible to treat anyone because the space between the goal and the railings was very confined. Eventually, the sheer number of fans overwhelmed the few police presence, and the goal was removed and placed out the way by the fans. Second, there was a gate at the front of the Leppings Lane end, which was locked. It was eventually opened, but within seconds, a group of policemen forced the gate closed in the faces of the fans. Presumably, they considered too many people were on the pitch. The gate was later reopened, and some policemen helped carrying fans out. However, by this time, the majority of police had withdrawn to the halfway line where they formed a security cordon. The vast majority of rescue and resuscitation attempts was made by fans who had escaped uninjured and fans who had left the main stands to assist. I saw very few police doing anything to assist. When an ambulance finally arrived at the ground, which I think was about 3:20, it entered at the Notts Forest end through a gate slightly wider than a single ambulance. As the ambulance approached the gate, a policeman stepped in front of it and stopped it from progressing onto the pitch. We commented to each other that we still could not believe that the police were more concerned over protecting the grass than rescuing people. Injured people then needed to be carried the length of the pitch to reach the ambulances outside. There appeared to be only three or four stretchers available. Fans started to dismantle advertising hoardings to use as stretchers. Police ran across to stop them. Again, there was a confrontation between the fans and the police. Sheer weight of numbers of fans forced the police back. Many other fans then started likewise dismantling advertising hoardings, and soon the ball boys also ran onto the pitch to do likewise. As injured fans and advertising hoardings were being carried out the length of the pitch by other fans, they had to cross the police cordon on the halfway line. To start with, the police would stop each group to check. I don't know what they were checking. We commented to each other that we still could not believe that the police were treating this as a crowd control exercise, and that somehow the fans were faking taking someone to an ambulance so as to reach the Notts Forest end. I should add that by this time I counted at least 10 bodies covered in coats, with limp limbs hanging by their side on advertising hoardings. It was clear that these fans had died. Later, the police tended to allow most stretchers pass without stopping them. However, they would still occasionally stop a group of fans and check. I did not see more than a couple of policemen actually helping injured fans. The few that did so stopped shortly afterwards and withdrew to the halfway security cordon. Someone sat close to me and began counting the bodies that appeared to be dead. He was counting those bodies carried on stretchers or advertising hoardings where a coat or something similar had been draped over the body. By the time he had reached 42, we decided that we should leave. I noted that it was half time, so we left the ground. The other thing I wanted to read to you, I said I'm just going to concentrate on witness evidence today, is a statement from the ambulanceman Tony Edwards. He was the only ambulance attendant to make it onto the pitch. He's given some press interviews for, I think, the first time in the past couple of weeks, and I've put this together from his press interviews. He stated that we have no idea what we were going to. We started the day picking up patients for transfer to hospital. We were then diverted to Hillsborough when it came over our radio that there had been one fatality at the stadium, and we didn't think anything of it. It might just have been a heart attack or something. As we were guided in, I could see other ambulances arriving. A police officer said, "You can't go on the pitch, they're still fighting." My boss reached into the cab, switched on our horns and said, "Drive onto that pitch and don't stop till you reach the far end." The first thing we saw was a group of Liverpool fans running towards us carrying an advertising hoarding, the type you see around the edge of the stadium. They were using it like a stretcher. There was a body on it, a big heavy guy, and he had his t-shirt pulled over his face. I thought, that guy's dead. Then we noticed the police had put a cordon halfway up the pitch, but there was a gap in it. It was through this gap that more groups of fans were running. They were banging on the sides of the van, shouting at us to stop, but we were told not to stop until we reached the far end, so we kept going. I still remember how the song changed when we drove through that cordon. When the ambulance came to a halt at the 18-yard line, Tony stepped out, this is the driver, this is the ambulance man, with a mask and bag resuscitation kit. The driver stayed in the ambulance. As I got out of the vehicle, we were swamped by desperate fans begging for help with their gravely injured friends or relatives. A woman came up to me and said she'd been resuscitating someone. I kept looking at the pitch to see if other ambulances were coming. I was taken with the woman, and the other people were shouting at me for oxygen, for a doctor, for a defibrillator. There was a huge amount of demands and massive confusion. I kept looking to see if someone else was coming. I was not expecting to be the incident officer. Clearly this was a major incident, and clearly no one was fighting. I saw four people on billboards on their backs. If there had been trained people about, these people would have been put in the recovery position. All I was looking for was the other ambulance crews. I knew I couldn't handle this on my own. I tried to call for help on the radios, but the radios didn't work. Bodies lay all around, and frantic fans grabbed at me, pleading for help. I searched for signs for someone who could be saved. I was trying to choose people I thought we could help. I saw a man doing CPR on a young girl. I said, "Let's get her." By the time I got to the ambulance, I looked down, and it was a different girl. We'd taken the wrong one. In the ambulance, I had Victoria Hicks and Trevor Hicks trying to resuscitate his daughter. There was a Nottingham lady trying to save someone else's life. There was a body by my legs, and a policeman was holding some oxygen. We had three people in the ambulance, which normally takes at best one. I was standing over a body I couldn't attend to. I then said that we had to get off the pitch to get to hospital. The ambulance was so full of bodies, I had to pull out. but no other ambulance has replaced my vehicle. None of the people I took from the pitch that day survived. Why were the 42 other ambulances kept off the pitch? Why was I the only ambulanceman on the pitch? I don't believe these questions have been answered properly, even after 20 years. People have been dishonest. I feel sorry that there were people who were perfectly savable, but they weren't getting any priority. Most of the ambulances were parked by the gym, but not coming through onto the pitch. 80 trained ambulance men. I always thought I'd be interviewed for the Taylor inquiry, but I later found out I wasn't because of the ruling that everyone was dead by 3:15 p.m. I don't agree with that and it should be challenged. It was a convenient time, but what if they weren't dead? What if crews had been on the pitch with proper equipment? It's nonsense. It's professional arrogance. You wouldn't know how many dead there were if crews didn't get inside the perimeter fence. When we got off the pitch, I knew there were people there that still needed to be helped. That's all I wanted to say about what's happened at the ground. Does anyone else want to speak about what happened before we talk to, before Sheila talks about her involvement? Okay, I mean, that's something we can come back to later.
Thanks.